This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 24 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. In this episode, we'll be discussing some of the deeper questions raised by the third season Next Generation episode, The Bonding. Well, Zachary, here we are. We're going to talk about this episode. It's kind of a heavy episode, but there's some lighthearted, comical aspects of the episode I'm sure we'll get into this week.
Well, if you've been listening to Metatrex for the last couple of weeks, we have a new associate producer for Metatrex, Patrick Devlin, who you may have heard us talk about at the end of our shows the last couple of weeks. And I was talking with Patrick on Facebook, and he asked me a question. He said, "Have you guys done an episode on The Bonding?" And I said, "No, I haven't." He said, "Have you thought about doing one?" I said, "Well, I don't really know what we talk about." I told him I'd think about it, and I thought about it. I said, "Let's just do it. Let's see what philosophical material we can flesh out of this episode that I hadn't really considered doing an episode of Metatrex on."
Yeah, surprisingly enough, there is more in here to talk about than even what I had first anticipated when we were discussing the show this week. So, Patrick, thanks for suggesting this. And Zachary, I should say, we want to invite our listeners always to jump in to a conversation in the Babel Conference under any of our posts, or be sure to tag either myself or you, Zachary, or mention Metatrex in a comment, and certainly suggest episode ideas. If there's a topic that you would like us to cover in the podcast, by all means, let us know what it is. Give us some ideas of what your thoughts are, and we would be more than happy to consider those for upcoming episodes of Metatrex.
Yeah, without a doubt, listeners are going to have make different connections in their minds and see different ideas for show topics. You know, you and I have ideas, but we have a bunch of creative listeners out there who are smart and make interesting connections, and we want to bring those onto the show too when we get a chance to.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's funny because oftentimes I'll follow. I don't always comment, but I try to get involved anytime we get a discussion thread going under one of our posts, and almost always when there's a discussion about one of our episodes, someone will mention something and say, "Well, you forgot to mention, you know, this, that, or the other thing." And it's funny. It's difficult to fully address a topic, you know, in an hour and a half podcast. And, you know, oftentimes our listeners think of things that really didn't cross our mind. You're absolutely right, making connections that, perhaps you and I didn't make when we were preparing for the podcast.
Yeah, I sort of think of it as a given that there's no possible way we can flesh out every nuance of every topic in an hour or an hour and a half podcast. But like you said, the Babel Conference Trek FM's listeners group is a perfect place to continue the discussion. So, you know, if we manage to leave something out, or you see connections we didn't make, or want to throw your own two cents in, or bring up an argument or a counter argument that we didn't talk about on the show, put it out there on the Babel Conference and use that as the continuation of the podcast.
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you know, certainly if we discuss a particular topic on one of our podcasts that was suggested by one of our listeners, we'll give you a shout out. If you throw a comment or an idea out, we might even you know, quote that comment or bring it up as a major point of the discussion. We also want to invite our listener, Zachary, to visit iTunes, our store on iTunes, and if they haven't subscribed to the podcast, to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out tremendously, helps other people find us as they search iTunes for podcasts. And certainly, while you're there, leave us a rating and review. We've been reading reviews as we get them here on the podcasts. If you leave us a review, especially if you leave it in one of the international iTunes stores, be sure and send us a note via the Babel Conference or connect with us on Twitter or Facebook. We'll give you our contact information at the end of the podcast today. Let us know that you did that so we can look it up and make it a part of a Metatrex episode.
Yeah, hitting the subscribe button in iTunes or in the Apple Podcast app and taking the time to leave a rating and a review, those are some of the simplest things you can do that will really help out the show. It helps other listeners find the show. Apple has some sort of magic algorithm they use to you know, place podcasts in the podcast search results. And those little things, while they don't take much time, really do help us out and get the word out that we're trying to do something new and interesting with Star Trek and philosophy.
Absolutely. Well, Zachary, how about we talk about The Bonding? This is, as you mentioned, a season three episode of The Next Generation. Marla Astor is a subordinate of Commander Worf's. She is killed during an away mission, leaving her young son, Jeremy, orphaned. The crew of the Enterprise work together to help Jeremy cope, and Worf suggests taking Jeremy into his house through a ritual called Rust'ai, or The Bonding. However, Jeremy is visited by an alien posing as his mother, who's offered him a chance to be with her again in an ideal setting, just like the home they once shared. Interesting, interesting episode of TNG here in the third season.
I think what I like about this episode right off the bat is it's one of these episodes in a series of episodes that really tries to develop Klingon culture and give Worf some backstory. And, you know, we learn a bit more about Worf himself having been an orphan. We learn a bit about Klingon culture with this ritual. And this is a fairly early episode in Star Trek The Next Generation. Of course, those things get fleshed out more in later seasons four and five and whatnot in Star Trek The Next Generation. But this is one of the early ones, and it's a fascinating first look into Klingon culture and an important part of Worf's character development.
This is really, really an interesting episode in which, you know, we do see the layers of this very rich culture that's been created in the Star Trek universe. The ceremony that Jeremy Astor and Worf observe near the end of the episode, I thought was a really great moment in the episode. I always enjoy it when they talk the Klingon.
Well, you know, the Klingon language has those great guttural staccato sounds, right?
Yes. Well, apparently Worf likes it too. We were talking in the turbo lift that scene when at the end of the episode Worf speaks the incantation, if you will, and Jeremy asks him, you know, what was that you said? And it's funny because Worf doesn't give him a translation. He only says, "It honors our mothers." And, you know, Jeremy gives a nod and he says, "Sos G, Batloth.
Sos G, Batloth. So."
What does that mean?
"It honors the memory of our mothers. We have bonded, and our families are stronger."
Sos G, Batloth. So.
And Worf gets this great twinkle in his eye and looks at him like, "Yeah, that sounds like a Klingon."
I have this great sort of, in my head canon, you know, young Jeremy Astor grows up and he keeps this Klingon identity. So he goes to work and he brings his Batloth with him. And every time he gets angry at something, he, you know, yells out some Klingon, you know, smashes something. Exactly. So there you go.
Yeah, but unfortunately, and I think it's probably one of the shortcomings, not really of the episode, but of the storyline itself, this storyline was really rich with all kinds of opportunity to bring it back and, you know, kind of revisit and explore it further later on in the series. And unfortunately, we never did. We never saw Jeremy Astor again. And, you know, I have this in my head canon I see Worf, you know, at Klingon Christmas time, you know, setting a table, a place for Jeremy at the table, at his family Christmas dinner. And, you know, Jeremy never shows up. He never calls. He just, you know, Alexander has to remind Worf, you know, Dad, he's not showing up.
And then the space telephone rings, and Alexander's like, "Oh, there's crazy Uncle Jeremy, you know, the crazy uncle who still thinks he's Klingon." Yeah. Exactly. Well, you make a good point, which is that it's surprising they didn't harken back to this a little bit. I mean, the theme of the episode is dealing with loss or death, right? And that's such a permanent thing that people have to deal with. You know, people who've lost someone they care about, they'll never exactly get over it. You can learn to live with it, but you're always going to miss the person. There will always be this question of meaning. What did their life mean? What did their death mean? And that's a long-term question. That's not something you wrap up neatly at the end of an episode. I do like that they harken back to this episode in a later episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. The episode where Worf is going to wants to commit suicide because his back has been injured. You know, Riker really gives him a talking to. He's saying, you know, look at all these people we've lost. How many people have we lost in the line of duty? I've lost count. You know, Tasha Yar and Marla Astor. And I like that they drop Marla Astor's name in that episode. So they do at least harken back to it. But you're right. You know, we don't get to see young Jeremy Astor again. And, you know, we are left wondering, did he grow up to be crazy, you know, Klingon speaking Uncle Jeremy?
Yeah, we never even mention him. And I think we probably all have that one family member that no one really talks about. maybe that's Jeremy Astor in the House of Worf here, the House of. Well, I want to say House of Moog, but it actually becomes the House of Martok. Well,
Klingons don't send Christmas cards, right? So, they send some sort of Klingon holiday card. So at least Worf is going to send Jeremy whatever the Klingon equivalent of a Christmas card is.
And I'm pretty sure that Worf, you know, never really discussed Jeremy Astor with Martok. He didn't even mention his own son, so I'm not sure that he would mention his adopted human half-brother.
Well, okay, so I think Martok would have been okay with this, right? Martok was okay with Jadzia Dax as Worf's wife. You know, she's a non-Klingon. He would have been okay with Jeremy the human, you know, joining the House of Martok. Martok's wife, though, would not have liked that one bit, right? She wasn't happy with a non-Klingon wife.
Absolutely
for Worf.
Absolutely not.
She wouldn't have liked Jeremy Astor joining the House of Martok. I'd put money on that.
Well, Zachary, as you mentioned, this episode does begin with a very heavy topic, as I mentioned in the synopsis. Marla Astor, who is a subordinate of Worf's, she is killed during an away mission. And so immediately in this episode, we're dealing with loss. We're dealing with death, which we all joke about the red shirts in Star Trek. But in truth, it seems like we do a lot of galloping around the galaxy. And you would imagine that something so risky, something so dangerous, as often as they're going on away missions and, you know, the highly technical and volatile things that they're dealing with in running a starship every day, you would imagine that they would lose people often. But surprisingly enough, in the Star Trek universe, we really, at the end of the day, don't see a lot of death. And so here we are, you know, in the midst of the third season, and we're confronted with the death of a character. Even though she wasn't a main character, we're facing the death that has had an impact, particularly on Worf, certainly on her son, although, again, we didn't know him. But we saw how it invoked feelings with Wesley Crusher and Beverly Crusher in remembering, hearkening back to the loss of Jack Crusher. So we have to deal with this.
Well, I think the question of death is an interesting one because it just gets right to the heart of the human condition. At the end of the day, it seems like every time there's a death, however meaningful the death might be, however good of a cause it was for, there's always this kind of absurd element. Like, really, that was it. There was this human life, and then it's blinked out of existence, and that's the end of the story, right? And there's an absurdity to that. Like, it seems hollow. It seems empty. It doesn't seem like you can really find any deep purpose to it when you're staring that death in the face. And like you said, this is actually one of the only real graphic depictions of death we get in Star Trek, right? You know, we get to see Marla Astor looking bloodied and like she was hit by an explosion. Worf's, you know, clothes are all torn. He looks like he was hit by a blast. It's a fairly graphic depiction for Star Trek. It was still, you know, pretty tame in the grand scheme of things compared to, you know, depictions in film and whatnot. But for Star Trek, this was, I think, a little less tame than most of the depictions that you see. So it really did try to kind of force the issue kind of head on. This is a fairly graphic situation. It happened in the blink of an eye. And it seems senseless at the end of the day. Like, you know, it was caused by this ancient relic of an old war that was buried underground. And what was the purpose of it? And I think it just gets to the heart of the human condition. Every death is like that. At the end of the day, what does human life or Klingon life, what does life mean for any of us, given that it's going to end at some point? And there's lots of answers to that question. But Worf's answer is interesting because he has to give a very Klingon answer. It's not just finding meaning in the person's life. For a Klingon, it's important to have a good death, right? The death itself has to be a meaningful death. So Worf would not have liked the meaningless death of Tasha Yar in season one. And he doesn't like the meaningless death of Marla Astor here. And for Klingons, it's a matter of dying in the line of duty or dying for a cause, dying in battle, dying for the Empire. But it's very important that death not be meaningless. And I love the idea that you can try to give that meaning death by going through this ritual, right? That in doing this aspect of Klingon culture, this Rustai ritual with Jeremy Astor, that somehow brings meaning after the fact to Marla Astor's death. And that's a very Klingon way to look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny you mentioned, you know, finding meaning in the death. That actually comes up several times in the episode. Worf says I can't seek revenge against an enemy who's turned to dust centuries ago. Mm-hmm. And he says her death was senseless. She was the last victim of a forgotten war. And later on, when he's talking to Jeremy, he says to Jeremy, you know, we have to. I think the words he used, we have to find meaning. And so it got me thinking about, you know, death and its meaning and what it means. And it's fascinating, I think, the way we see, for instance, Riker is in 10 Forward early in the episode. And I really appreciate this scene because there's something very gritty about it. You know, he's there, he's having his drink, he's alone, it's not like he's straddled a chair, he's trying to, you know, pick up some young ensign, but, you know, he's there alone, he's drinking, he's brooding a little bit, I think, mourning a little bit, and, you know, there's this really interesting conversation that he has with Data as Data tries to understand the connections that people have and how they deal with the death of a comrade. And that particular scene was interesting. Again, I mentioned Wesley and Beverly Crusher, you know, having the conversation about how this has, you know, invoked feelings that, you know, perhaps they had suppressed to some degree. There's several references back to the loss of Tasha Yar in season one. So as we do have this tendency to search for meaning, oftentimes it does cause us to recount past loss in our lives. And we all deal with death differently. We all look at it differently. And so I think it's fascinating, even though it's difficult to deal with such a heavy topic in a 42-minute episode of a science fiction show, I think this episode does it some justice in looking at Marla Astor's passing through many different eyes.
I think what I love about this episode is it's trying to sort of maybe fight two fronts at the same time. Not only is it trying to expose the potential meaninglessness of human existence, the arbitrariness, the absurdity of life and death from a human standpoint. But it's also trying to point out the arbitrariness of human emotions. You know, I like that conversation between Riker and Data is fascinating because Data raises a really good point. Why should it matter how much you know someone? Why is that the deciding factor for how much we should feel the significance of their death or how important or how much weight we give it emotionally, right? And you know, Riker kind of says that's just human nature, you know. Yeah. And that there's no deep answer to that. You know, we have these emotional connections that are not. You can't explain in any rational way. If you know someone more, you're going to care about them more. You're going to feel the loss more if that person dies or gets injured or whatnot. But from Data's standpoint, who is really the mirror of, the sort of neutral, objective, analytical mirror to the human condition, Data says, well, that doesn't make sense, right? Wouldn't it be, shouldn't we feel the death of every person equally? Mm-hmm. Why should this carry any weight? And Riker says, yeah, that's a good point. Imagine what the world would be like if we did, you know, treat the death of every person with significance, not just the people we care about. You know, how different would the universe be if that were the case? And they just kind of leave that as an open question. But it does to me kind of, it's a good counterpoint to the arbitrariness of death. There's this arbitrariness in our reactions to death.
Yeah, I believe the question that Data asked was, you know, should not the feelings run just as deep regardless of who's died? And that's a profound question when you think about it, because whether we are close to that person or not, we all have familial connections and friendships, and we have a place, in the world that we live in. We all get up every day and we live our lives and we're connected. You do have this tendency, I think, to ponder loss, even when it's not directly connected to you. You see, mourners on television when they've, when they've lost somebody on the news. Someone noteworthy passes away, and we're moved when we watch the coverage of their funeral or their wake or some other gathering of friends and family. We create monuments and we lay flowers at the places where we've lost people, and you've got to know whether that touches you as an individual directly or not. You know, someone's touch, someone's life has been altered in some way because of that loss.
And, it's funny you mentioned the question of taking up, I don't want to say responsibility, but taking up, making other people's problems or someone else's pain your own. In my mind, Worf is doing something incredibly noble in this episode. Worf is, in fact, taking Jeremy Astor's pain and making it his own. And there's a duality to it, because Worf on the one hand feels guilty, right? Marla Astor was killed under Worf's command, so he feels guilty, and he's possibly trying to alleviate his own guilt in doing this as well. But he can relate to Jeremy Astor as an orphan. Worf knows he can play this mentoring role. He can add meaning to Marla Astor's death in some Klingon sense. So he takes it upon himself to form a relationship with this boy that he doesn't have to form a relationship with, right? He has no obligation to, not even a moral obligation, right? This is totally voluntary, right? And it's a really noble thing that he's doing. And so Worf is doing the very thing that Riker is suggesting.
Yeah, without a doubt. And for many reasons, I think you mentioned perhaps to alleviate his own sense of guilt. And I'm sure, being the commander of an away mission, he would feel a certain sense of guilt. He was responsible, after all, in a very real sense, for her safety and her well-being. So I'm sure there is the weight of, perhaps the weight of, could there have been something that I would have done different? Worf might be thinking that perhaps would have assured that she would have survived. Certainly there's a real a real phenomenon, survivor's guilt, mm-hmm. where you feel guilty because you've survived. We see that oftentimes, in mass tragedies when many people have been killed, perhaps in an accident, an airline accident or a car accident, mm-hmm. and somebody survives and ends up feeling, why was it me? And that's a very real phenomenon. So perhaps he's feeling that. But it's interesting because Worf harkens back to his own experiences as a young boy losing his own parents. And how he was bettered because of the compassion of a human Starfleet officer. So here is a really nice picture of Worf trying to do, I think, for Jeremy Astor, something that someone was kind and compassionate enough to do for him, which is very un-Klingon. Don't you agree?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, Klingons are multifaceted, right? On the one hand, Klingons don't tend to be overly generous helping other people, right? They tend to be somewhat stoic. They tend to they do things out of duty and honor. You know, compassion is not necessarily the Klingon strong suit. On the other hand, Worf, I think Worf's actions here in this episode could be viewed as totally in line with some sort of universal Klingon moral code, right? You know, it's an objective fact for Klingons that death needs to have a purpose. And, you know, that is this driving force behind a lot of what Worf is trying to do. Is it done out of compassion for its own sake? I'm not really sure. It's definitely noble. I think he doesn't have to do it, right? But whether it's done out of compassion or not, I'm not sure, because it seems more like it's a matter of Klingon duty and honor and meaning and these things that are sort of objective Klingon values from Worf's standpoint, rather than necessarily compassion for Jeremy.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the Rustai, Rustai and the Klingon, they call it. I mean, they have this ritual, and it would be interesting to know a little bit more about what purpose this particular ritual served outside of this situation. I actually looked up Rustai on Memory Alpha. There's really not much more about it beyond the context of this particular episode, but I think it would be interesting. You know, perhaps this is kind of one of those duty laden honor type rituals that you know, Klingons do when they've lost somebody in battle. You know, to comfort one another. Perhaps this might be a comfort, a care type ethic among Klingons, you know, after battle or something. I don't know.
Well, I think it does speak to the importance of rituals in general, sociologically and culturally, right? I mean, rituals bind people together. They bind communities, they bind families, they bind, you know, communities of faith or common belief systems, whatnot. You know, different groups have their different rituals and practices. Every group has them, right? You know, whether it's things you do at your job or things you do at a church or things you do in a synagogue or things you do in your neighborhood. You know, their rituals are just how we function, these unwritten rules that we live by. So for Klingons, it is just this thing that happens when there's a death. If you have to give it some meaning, then you do this ritual, and it serves all these really deep, interesting functions for Klingons that maybe humans can't really understand. And Jeremy Astor gets this insight into the meaning of those rituals. I think from our standpoint, yeah, we probably don't understand all the nuances of what that ritual means for Klingons, but it does seem to serve some important function, that it at least adds some meaning to the death. It at least binds people together. It at least, you know, I could probably fill in a couple more things there, but it serves this sort of cultural and sociological function for Klingons and for the rest of us. You know, all of us, every group of people has its own rituals and meaningful practices that if you didn't have those, there would be a lack of meaning there. Those are the things that add meaning to people's lives.
Yeah, you look at our own human history and how over the course of our known history in different cultures, how we have dealt with death. And you see everything from, you know, for instance, in ancient Egypt, you know, the process of preserving, embalming, and, you know, they fill a storehouse for a king so that he's got those things in the afterlife, even members of his family, servants that he had, pets, you know, everything kind of gets buried with them. You know, week-long mourning rituals in some cultures, even in our own culture, Zachary, over the course of American history, you know, the last 250 years or so, the way we as Americans deal with death here in the United States, and you know, in some it's a very it's a very difficult time of great mourning, and while others it's, you know, it's barely passing. In my own family, you know, my family actually has kind of a history now of, you know, donating their remains to science, human gift registries. And you know, when my, for instance, when my grandmother passed away, my father passed away, we didn't have a funeral. You know, we said goodbye in the hospital, and that was, you know, that was kind of it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when my mother-in-law passed away a few years ago, she had a very celebratory, funeral. It was, not a time of tearful mourning at all, but rather, you know, an upbeat, celebration of sorts. And, as our, many of our listeners know, I've been 25 years in, you know, Christian ministry in the Christian church, and I've done hundreds of funerals for infants, and the oldest person I think was 97, you know, that I've had the privilege of laying to rest. And I've seen it all in terms of the way, you know, different groups, different families, different cultures, you know, deal with death. And for that matter, the facticity of it, the absoluteness of death.
You know, it's funny, as on the one hand, I don't have a lot of experience with death. You know, I've lost all my grandparents are gone at this point. Other family and friends over the years have died. And, you know, it's tough because on the one hand, you miss those people. I miss my grandparents terribly. I'm kind of like Jeremy Astor in a way. I would give my right arm to have my grandparents back and get five mm-hmm. more minutes with them. But that's not going to happen, right? we don't have a magic an alien here who can, you know, magically, you know, create a an environment from the past, or we don't have a holodeck, so that
fortunately
doesn't happen,
right? So because she was quite a creepy facsimile.
Yeah, I kind of have this like crazy like image of like this, you know, some alien version of my grandmother or something. I don't want to live in that fantasy. So. But so I guess on the one hand, it's like, it always hurts and it's always sad and there's always a mourning period. On the other hand, the thing that's a little disturbing about it is you can get really desensitized to death, right? You see it every day on the news. You hear it read it in the newspapers, see it on TV. The more people you've lost in your life, the more routine it becomes. And I think this is a matter of getting older, right? I mean, you know, you and I are creeping up on middle age. Maybe neither one of us really qualifies as middle age yet. You think your best years are done, but I don't buy it. But you know, we're in our 30s and 40s, and you know, at this point, we've racked up a few of these, right? I've lost all my grandparents. I've lost some friends. This has become a little bit routine. And I couldn't have said that when I was 15 or 16 years old. Mm-hmm. Or some people can, sadly. Some people experience this very young, and I don't have that experience. But I think as you get older, this becomes more normal. And you can become really desensitized to the point where it doesn't phase you anymore. And that's Data's point, maybe, is that shouldn't we feel this all the time? And you can get really desensitized to the point where it becomes routine, or it doesn't move you, or it doesn't cause you to try to fix problems in the world. It can be such a fact of life that you don't, don't give it it doesn't trouble you like it should. You know, think of all the death going on in the world right now. Think how troubling that should be, and how much we just seem to go through our ordinary lives day in and day out, and we don't dwell on that. You know, I think if we did, we'd probably drive ourselves crazy. We can't dwell on that, right? But maybe we should a little more. And I think that's maybe the heart of Data's question. You know, this seems like it can get routine at a certain point.
Absolutely. And, you know, Zachary, I think, too, the way we view death, I think, has an incredible impact on how we deal with it. For instance, you know, in this particular episode, I think there is a heaviness about it because of the way she died. And I think mm-hmm. that has quite a bit to do with it as well. But Star Trek, over its many iterations, has dealt with this through the lens of different cultures. The Vulcan culture, you know, we kind of see the way they view death. Certainly, we understand the human aspect of it. In the Klingon culture, a good death is a good thing to be celebrated, and Something that they drink and they celebrate when somebody enters the gates of Stovelcore.
It's a good day for Roostai.
It's a great day for break out the blood wine. It's a great day for Roostai. as they pull their eyelids open and scream into the air, announcing that a warrior is about to enter Stovelcore. But and even that particular ritual, when we first saw that for the first time, that's very foreign to us, as I imagine it should have been. And for instance, in Voyager, in the first season, the episode is called Emanations. We see that particular culture and the way they deal with death. It's something that they look forward to and prepare for. And, it's a time of celebration for a family and preparation and ritual. And poor Harry Kim didn't share that particular point of view. But, they viewed death as a chance to move on to that next emanation, that next
plane of existence.
Plane of existence. Yeah.
I've got a question for you about this, Mike. So, sure. In Star Trek, we see any number of different cultures about death, right? The Klingons deal with death in a certain way. That race in Voyager that you just mentioned deals with death in a different way. Mm-hmm. Vulcans deal with it in their way, right? We see hundreds of these over the many hundreds of hours of Star Trek on television. So given the plurality of different cultures' way of dealing with death, I mean, humans have this too, right? Different cultures within the human species have this diversity. Does that add to the meaning of death, or does that amplify the absurdity of it? I think, it's beautiful that each culture has its own way of dealing with death. I think there is a, last week on Metatrex, we did an episode on infinite diversity and infinite, combinations, mm-hmm. the Vulcan philosophy. So there is kind of an aesthetic beauty to the plurality of worldviews and cultures that are out there from this cultural anthropologist sense.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it strikes me that maybe the plurality of ways of dealing with death really heighten the absurdity. No one of those cultures probably has universal claim to the meaning of death. And so given that, there's no one way of dealing with death that gives it meaning for all of us, for everyone, for all time, doesn't it seem even more arbitrary and even more potentially meaningless given that?
I think the simple answer to your question is yeah, to some degree, absolutely. I can talk about my own beliefs on death. Certainly I have faith based on, the revelation of scripture. But at the end of the day, can I say with absolute certainty that I know exactly what's going to happen when I take my last breath here on planet Earth? And the answer to that question is, no, I can't say for certain. I certainly have faith, great faith, that when I take my last breath here, I'll enter into God's presence. But, for me to, for me to say with certainty that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, I don't. And none of us do. That's what makes death such a great mystery. I think it's what makes it something that is debated. You mentioned the plurality, because we all have our own customs and our own beliefs. We talk about the other cultures, Vulcans and Klingons and humans, but even in the human culture, we have certainly many different ideas of what happens. There's there's a belief in reincarnation. There's a belief that you just go into nothingness. You cease to exist. And the absurdity is that at the end of the day, no one truly knows for certain. Again, I have my faith and I'm strong and certain in my faith, but to say that I know for certain, I've never experienced it. So if I ever do, and I live to tell you about it, I'll be glad to enlighten you, but that's never happened. To a true mortal flesh and blood human being.
It happened to Lindsay Ballard in Voyager, though.
It did, indeed.
So we have a couple of cases, and Spock, of course, came back from the dead. So there are a few people in Star Trek that have come back from the dead and actually have the answer, right?
Yes.
But I think, I guess, in my mind, it's just never a question of certainty, right? Yeah, none of us knows what death is really like and if there's anything after death or not. You know, it's not a question of certainty. It's a question of meaning. You know, I guess, maybe this is more like a personal question for you even. Does the fact that there are people who believe different things, a lot of people who believe different mm-hmm. things than you, yes, okay, it's not a question of certainty. You can't prove what you believe. They can't prove what they believe. But does the presence of these many different belief systems, does that undermine the meaningfulness of what you believe in any way?
It doesn't, Zachary. You know, I consider myself a thinking Christian. I've never been one to believe anything blindly, and I've been one to always research. So my faith is not something that's superficial. I was 19 when I became a believer in Christianity, a believer in Christ, and so you know I grew up outside of the church culture and. I was already well on my way to being a very independent thinker, and probably at a time when many people who are raised in a faith-based atmosphere are oftentimes moving away from their faith, I actually came to faith through great skepticism. So to say that someone else having a differing belief undermining my own, particularly about death, it doesn't. You know, I do believe the witness of Scripture when it comes to, you know, we mentioned, you know, no one having died and come back to life, you know, in the Christian faith, you know, we believe that Jesus is such a person who died, who spent 3 days. We just celebrated Easter, which is the observance in the Christian faith of the resurrection of Christ from the dead. And so, you know, I do hang my hat, so to speak, on that. And it doesn't bother me. It doesn't offend me when others have differing beliefs. I respect them all because, again, at the end of the day, you know, my only proof is an empty grave.
You know, in Star Trek, it strikes me that, you know, death is never really dealt with in this nihilistic sense. You know, there's a meaningfulness to being on our starship and going out of the universe and exploring and, you know, this kind of quest to go out in the universe and explore and form new relationships mm-hmm. with other races. There's a meaningfulness to that. And that kind of inherently gives a death in Star Trek meaning, right? You know, Tasha Yar's death, while it might have seemed a little arbitrary, was meaningful insofar as she was in Starfleet and she plays this role in going out and exploring the galaxy. I think like when here on Earth, I think when the Challenger exploded, right? That's an arbitrarily, 30 something years ago now, that was an arbitrary event that was sad. It wasn't a meaningful event in itself because, it's because it was so arbitrary, right? Just boom, random explosion, an O-ring fails and the ship explodes and everyone dies. Mm-hmm. And that's it seems senseless and it points to how fragile life really is. On the other hand, there's this rich meaningfulness. You know, we view those people as intrepid explorers, right? Read a lot of meaning into their lives based on the role that they play, the kind of life they wanted to live, the kinds of adventure they wanted to be on. And I think in Star Trek, you get that inherently. Every life in Star Trek is meaningful because they're all in this grand, epic, exploratory quest together in the Star Trek universe. But there is this question of arbitrariness. You know, Tasha Yar's death seemed arbitrary. Marla Astor's death seems sudden and arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And a lot of death like that in the real world is like that. I think of people who've gone to war and seen the futility of and the wastefulness of life, when your comrades and friends are dying around you. Anyone who's gone to war has some experience like that. I haven't myself, but I know a lot of people who have. I want to give you a personal anecdote. I was a juror on a murder trial some years ago. It was a 6 week long cold case murder trial where a murder was unsolved for 20 something years. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to sit through because it was graphic mm-hmm. and it was It was, I mean, I could see the victim's family and friends there in the courtroom, and I could see the pain in their eyes. And at the end of the day, none of it made any sense. Just stupid human behavior and human frailties and faults and whatnot caused this really crazy event to happen. And I just remembered being totally fixated on the arbitrariness of this. Like, you know, I can sort of close my eyes and I can see all the things I had to see during the trial, and I can, I remember even after the trial, I remember going to the victim's gravesite with her family and friends. And I remember it's weird stuff. It's like, you know, sitting around, after spending 6 weeks coming to care about someone you don't know. And Worf is kind of like this in this episode, right? He's coming to care about yes. Marla Astor and Jeremy. He doesn't really know them, but he's taken it upon himself to know them. And, you know, at the same time, what I really wanted to do at the end of it was to bring the victim back.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of it, I wanted to undo the entire stupid chain of events that led to this really tragic event that was really painful and for everyone. And I wanted to undo it. And you just can't snap your fingers and undo it. You do want to snap your fingers and bring people back to life, and your grandparents or your friends or, you know, strangers that you come to care about for one reason or another. You can't do that. And I think that's the kind of the futility of it. You know, we wish as humans that we have this power. We do have this creative power to live our own lives and make things happen and invent things and change things and control situations. But when death confronts all of that, it's this utter powerlessness that, you know, we wish we didn't have. And we don't live our lives that way. We tend not to live our lives as totally powerless, right? We make decisions all the time. We live our lives. It's what we do. But when death happens, you realize you're just utterly powerless to prevent it, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. And then the question is, what the hell does it all mean given that? What does my life mean given that I can't do anything about death, right? So in my mind, it's kind of this deep existential question. What role does death play for us here in the living world, right? You know I'm going to die someday. You know you're going to die someday. Hopefully, you know, we're in our 30s and 40s. Hopefully we've got 50 or 60 years, but maybe not. We might have 10 years or 15 years or 20 years.
We just don't know.
None of us knows, right? And so I guess the question is, what role does that play in our lives? Do you obsess on the absurdity of it? Do you try to find meaning in it in some way? How can you use that fact to motivate you to do certain things in life, right? I mean, for me, I hope it's a motivating factor, right? I only have so many days on this planet. You better make them good ones, right? You better, if there's goals you have or things you want to accomplish or, experiences you want to have or friendships you want to have, whatever it is, you know, the clock is ticking every single day. Time is ticking away, and you can either ignore that fact. And I think a lot of people do, right? They just don't think about it. They live their ordinary lives. They don't challenge themselves. They don't push themselves. They don't. And then they realize tragically somewhere towards the end of their life, you know, they'll find themselves 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 years old, and they haven't done any of those things they wanted to
right.
do. So in my mind, you know, the absurdity of death is something you can dwell on, or you can kind of embrace it as part of your own identity. And if you do that, that can be this really motivating factor to do whatever the heck you want to do with your life. Hopefully it's something great because you only have so many days.
Zachary, you mentioned, and I think you hit the nail right on the head. You mentioned it raises the question of, you know, what is the meaning of my life? You know, we can dwell on what does death mean, but I've got to be honest with you, and I don't want to sound calloused about death. Again, I have presided over hundreds of funerals over the course of 25 years, and many of those funerals, by the way, you know, were you know, personal family, personal friends. I mentioned that my own dad didn't have a funeral, but you know, when his ashes were released to us, you know, I officiated his memorial service when we buried his ashes on top of a hill in a cemetery in rural West Virginia. So it's fascinating to me because over the years I have seen people who have been confronted with the reality, the certainty of death, and it's caused them to reevaluate the choices that they've made and the way that they live their lives. I've seen people emerge from the death of someone close to them with a new resolve to live life in a different way, to take life, if you will, by the horns. And I think by and large, that theme is very prevalent in this particular episode of the Next Generation, because one of the reasons Worf, and for that matter, the entire crew of the Enterprise, is so concerned about Jeremy is that he's able to process this death in a healthy way and emerge from it and be able to go on and live the rest of his life. And the danger here is when the alien doppelganger shows up and offers Jeremy this kind of ideal existence where he'll have his mother and he'll have his old home and he'll have his cat, and all of these things are a facsimile, right? There's the danger there that he gets lost in something very hollow and doesn't really move on, doesn't really get past this and move on in life. Wesley and his mother have this same kind of conversation, you know, how Wesley was able to process it and the motivation. And we see this throughout the Star Trek universe. Oftentimes death becomes a very powerful motivator in the life of a character. And that's true in life as well.
One of my favorite scenes in the episode is when Captain Picard tells Jeremy that on the Starship Enterprise, no one is ever alone. Mm. And I love that scene because, you know, death can make you feel alone. If you've lost someone you care about, someone you had a relationship with, you're going to feel alone afterwards. That's a totally normal response. How could it be otherwise, right? And I think, you know, any kind of loneliness is like that. If you feel alone, what you need is desperately someone to latch on to you and make you not feel alone mm-hmm. anymore. And Worf does that for Jeremy. And Captain Picard does that for Jeremy in this episode, too, in a much less time-consuming way. You know, it's a moment in the episode, but it's not the extent of the relationship that Worf tries to build with Jeremy. But Picard is reaching out. Wesley's reaching out. And I guess my point is just that relationship building element of death is, you know, that's the way you overcome it. You find meaningfulness in the life and other relationships that you have. And that's what's going on sort of surrounding Jeremy. There's this bubble of affection and care and concern from everyone else on the Enterprise surrounding Jeremy Astor. And then along comes this alien and gives him, like you described it really well, a facsimile of that, right? That's not a real relationship with his mother. That's not really his cat. It's this cold artificialness. It's the illusion of happiness. It's the illusion of sincerity. And, you know, I think you can imagine what all of life would be like. What if Jeremy decided to go with her and he didn't live the rest of his life in a bubble? You know, that's less meaningful than living in the real world with all of its bumps and bruises and scars and joys and pleasures and, you know, all the genuineness that you get in the real world. I don't think any one of us would really want to sign up to live in this artificial created world, however joyful it would be. I wouldn't want to go live in a world with all my grandparents if they were just facsimiles and weren't the genuine people, right? It's just there. It's hollow. But the thing is, it's phenomenally the same experience, right? Jeremy can't tell the difference. It looks like his mother. That looks like his cat. That looks mm-hmm. like his couch. And those look like his ferns in the corner, right? And, you know, you just can't tell the difference. So that is an interesting, somewhat abstract question. If you literally can't tell the difference, why should there be a difference in the meaningfulness of it if phenomenally there is absolutely no difference? And yet, I think most people look at that hypothesis that you could live the rest of your life in this protective bubble that is an illusion or a facsimile or not genuine, and it seems hollow to us. But that seems a little paradoxical with the fact that it's phenomenally the very same experiences.
Kind of reminds me of the Schrodinger's cat problem in a different way, because you know that deals a little bit more, I think, with temporal mechanics. But you have Jeremy Astor and Patches the cat, and you know which one's real and which one isn't. You know, if we took him, you know, from this point in time and he's faced with his choice, you know, does he go with the facsimile of his mother or does he, you know, stay on board and face reality? And we're kind of forced to ask the question, you know, which one is real? Are they both real? I mean, in the choice of going with the facsimile of his mother, is that any less real if he experiences it? So I think there's some really interesting kind of mental exercises that we could go through and pick that apart.
Well, I think it speaks to the difference between subjective meaning and mm-hmm. objective meaning. And you can ask this question about death. You can ask the question about life. And here we're going to ask the question about, you know, Jeremy Astor's the meaningfulness of experiences that he finds valuable, right? So if he lives his life inside this protective bubble, this alien's artificial world she's created for him, you know, there's subjective meaning to that. You know, he's getting an emotional response from seeing his mother and seeing his cat, and that's meaningful to Jeremy from the first person's subjective point of view. But then when we look at it from the perspective of everyone else on the Enterprise, the third person, more objective viewpoint, there's an absurdity to that. Like, that's not genuine. That's a facsimile. That's not real relationships mm-hmm. and real experiences, and that's not meaningful from the objective third person standpoint. And you can ask that question about death too, right? There's the subjective meaning of death. What does it mean for you as an individual? What does it mean for your culture? And then there's this objective standpoint. What does death in general mean for humans and Klingons and any living being? And I think there's two aspects to that. There's the kind of individual cultural aspect, and then there's the universal aspect of it. And some of the things we've talked about, like the motivatingness of death to do something with your life, it seems like any being with a finite lifespan would have that motivational factor in some way. It would be relevant. It might play it out in different ways based on your culture, but there's something universal about that. Unless you're Data, right? There's this interesting question at some point in Star Trek. I think it's when in that episode, that two-part episode, Time's Arrow, when Data learns that he's going to die, you know, 500 years in the past, through some sort of time travel mechanism. But Data all of a sudden realizes that he's going to die someday. That makes him more human. But, you know, Data's hypothesis that he could conceivably live forever, that's an interesting question. What if death was never a factor? What would human mm-hmm. life be like then? What would the motivating factor for human life be? Would you want to live an infinite life where you can experience every experience you want? There's no threat of death. In my mind, that would be a less meaningful existence, right? I mean, at a certain point, you're going to have been there and done it all and tried everything there is to try, and you're going to get a chance to do it all over again because there's no threat of death and you're going to live forever. That seems like a life that I wouldn't want to live. I don't know what the Sure. motivating factor would be. I mean, you could turn into some sort of hedonist just trying to do every single thing there is to do, but it seems way more arbitrary than the fact that because we're going to die, it gives us this motivating factor. I think that could be seen as adding to the meaningfulness of life rather than taking away from it in the arbitrariness of death.
Yeah. It occurs to me, Zachary, as you were talking, this is probably a little less like Schrodinger's cat, maybe a little bit more like Plato's cave, you know, the allegory of Plato's cave. If this were, instead of Star Trek The Next Generation, if this were something more like The Matrix, you know, and we have Morpheus who says,
Morpheus.
Jeremy, what if I told you that Patches is not Patches? She's not your mother.
Yeah, I can picture Worf like, Jeremy, do you want the blue Batleth or the red Batleth?
But we do see Jeremy Astor at this place of decision. Does he go into the cave and live a life in shadows that certainly seem real, or, you know, does he face, you know, the harsh, cold reality? And you know, Captain Picard kind of alludes to that. You know, he even says, you know, could any of us really blame him, you know, for wanting that fantasy to you know, live the rest of his life in that bubble, you know, this pleasure machine that's being offered to him rather than the cold, hard reality of his existence. And, but, you know, I have to ask kind of that philosophical question, you know, is that facsimile any less real?
It strikes me, Mike, that this episode is really parallel and related to the Deep Space Nine episode, It's Only a Paper Moon. And if you want to hear more on Trek FM about that episode, It's Only a Paper Moon, you can find an episode of The Ready Room, Trek FM's flagship show. It's episode 197, Life with the Safeties On, in which we deconstruct that episode of Deep Space Nine, It's Only a Paper Moon. And in that episode, Nog has been injured. He's been in a war. He's lost his leg, and he's really retreating inward. You know, he's flirting with the idea of living his life inside the holosuite on Deep Space Nine in the Vic Fontaine program, doing all these things that are they're like a simulacrum of reality, right? They're talking about building a new casino, mm-hmm. but it's a holographic casino. They have customers, but they're holographic customers. And Nog is getting really into this, right. And it's meaningful for him. It actually, what's interesting to me is it is actually meaningful. It is doing something in his life. It's re-energizing him. He's reminding himself who he is and his interests and the things he cares about. And yet someone finally has to give him the kick out the door that you need to get out of the holosuite and go back into the real world. And I think life is kind of like that. There's this series of, you know, ups and downs. In the down times, when something's really bothering you, or there's a death, or things seem arbitrary, whatever it is, you can really retreat inwards in yourself. And there's a self-protectiveness way of doing that. I mean, you know, for Jeremy, you know, the possibility of, you know, living in this artificially created world with his mother and cat and whatnot, that's a protective bubble for him. And that's safe and reassuring. I mean, who wouldn't want to be have those feelings of safety and security in the down times, right? But you don't want to stay in those times. I think it's pretty clear from the third person standpoint that eventually, you know, life is going to get better. And even if it's not, you know, there's a meaningfulness to the tragedy of life. I mean, you can look at people who've had genuinely tragic lives, and you wouldn't wish that on anyone, of course. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying it's good to have a tragic life, right? You know, we all want to have a good life. But it's not that a tragic life is meaningless. There are people who've had tragic lives that you can point to and go, even though that was tragic, it was a real, genuine life, and there was meaning to it that we can see after the fact. I wouldn't wish it on anyone, maybe, but there's a meaningfulness because of its reality that is way deeper than anything you're going to get in an artificially created reality. So, you know, of course, Nog has to come out of the holosuite, and Jeremy needs to, you know, wake up and get outside this fantasy. He needs to see life will go on, and it may or may not get better, but at least needs to be real.
Sure. And we talked a little bit about this in Metatrex 10, I believe it was. There's always a glitch where we dealt with the problem of the external world. And I think that has some relevance to what we're talking about. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There comes a moment when, you know, somebody has to give you a kick in the pants, or you have to snap out of it and, you know, go and reemerge and live life. And whether it's, you know, a facsimile of mom and home and Patches the cat, or whether it's, you know, a holodeck program or an addiction, in our world, oftentimes, the tragedy of death drives people to addiction of one type or another, be it alcohol or drugs or, things that are, you and I would, you know, consider pleasurable, even games and gambling, and people can become addicted to all types of things, and very relative to, you know, what Nog was experiencing. He went into the holosuite and to the world of Dick Fontaine as a form of therapy, and everybody was fine with it. But after a time, it became a very unhealthy thing, and you know, he had to reemerge from it, and Jeremy too. Had to come to a point where he reemerged. But the great thing was, and you mentioned the scene with Captain Picard, and I too, every time I see that scene, I get a little choked up. You know, Picard, who by his own admission is not very good with kids, you know, reaches out very tenderly and touches Jeremy's hand and reassures him. You know, certainly Deanna Troi, and you see, you know, the possibility of a bond with Wesley Crusher, and certainly, you know, what Worf was willing to do, what Worfius was willing to do for Jeremy in taking him into his own house and being a mentor to him. I think, you know, these were all very powerful images of the support system that sometimes I think it takes in life to not just deal with death, Zachary, but to deal with life.
Yeah, I've actually been blessed with a really good support structure. I've got loving family members and, you know, friends that will stand by me no matter what. And there have been times when I've really retreated inward. And I use Star Trek this way sometimes. I you know, fully admit that I use Star Trek in this therapeutic, you know, self-protective bubble kind of way. If I've had a bad day, I will come home and I will put Star Trek on and I will get lost in it for an hour or two. And there's a therapeuticness to that is okay. I think anyone who really is passionate about fiction can relate to this in some way. But, you know, I also have friends that will drag me kicking and screaming, you know, out of that protective bubble. I have friends that will say, you know, let's go bowling, or let's go, you know, to a coffee shop, or let's go for a walk, or let's go to San Francisco for the day. You know, whatever it is, right? Just get out of your headspace and get back in the real world. And, you know, you need people like that in life, I think. And, you know, I've been blessed that way. And, you know, Jeremy Astor needs someone to drag him out of that protective bubble. And, you know, the crew is doing their best to do it. And just like Nog needs someone to kick him out of the Hollow Suite. You know, I think if you don't have that, it's very easy to get lost in your own headspace, you know, whether in a literal fictional world or a metaphorical one. And, you know, it's always better to be in the real world, even given its bumps and bruises.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on this because we are rolling up on an hour, but you had something in the notes for the episode, and we've kind of touched on it a couple of times, but what you're talking about there really makes the connection, and that is this idea of cross-cultural connections and mentoring. Really great picture there of Worf, who is a Klingon, albeit not a quintessential Klingon, but nevertheless, you know, someone who is very Klingon, taking responsibility, if you will, for this human boy, and mentoring him, and you know, being there for him in a relationship, so that he's able to cope and develop as normally as possible under the circumstances.
I find it touching because I think Worf would have been fully justified in taking a more Klingon approach, right? Worf could have said, you humans are wimps when it comes to death. Deal with it. and that would have been a perfectly fine Klingon response, right? But Worf doesn't do that. He finds that he really finds an interesting balance between respecting the emotional import of this death, right? This, the meaninglessness of his own parents' death, the meaninglessness of Marla Astor's death, the meaningfulness of life, and he takes, you know, the Klingon elements, the rituals and whatnot, and uses those to be a mentor to Jeremy in this very cross-cultural, you know, shared experience, emotional kind of sense that in my mind doesn't strike me as particularly Klingon. Mm-hmm. You know, he's reaching out in non-Klingon ways, all in the guise of Klingon ritual, so they can bond together in this shared universal experience of trying to find meaning in death. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I find this fascinating as well, because like you, I think my immediate thought in the way a Klingon would deal with this was, you know, kind of, you're absolutely right. You humans are wimps. You deal with it. His mother's in Stovalkor. Let's celebrate, you know.
Yeah, and those Klingons, remember, there's the first season episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, that episode where there's the three Klingons who are on board, and they're kind of serving this kind of mm-hmm. mentoring role to Worf in a way, teaching him how to be a Klingon in a way. And, you know, they take this very Klingon hard-nosed attitude towards death. They, you know, they yowl and they howl into the air when someone has died, and then they're done. The body's just a shell, and they're moving on to the next thing. And Worf could have taken that approach because he's already had a lesson in that from other Klingons.
Yeah, without a doubt. It, you know, Klingons do not sulk, Jeremy Astor.
Klingons do not sulk,
I can just see him handing the boy a blood wine and...
Klingons do not whine about death. Yeah,
Klingons right. do not sulk, Jeremy Astor. But instead, he takes really for a Klingon what seems to be a very tender approach, and that is wrapped up in this ritual and this rustai, this bonding of bringing Jeremy into his house and making this, you know, this commitment to make him family. And the thing that I find fascinating about it is the cross-cultural nature of that. I'm always moved when someone is able to look outside the confines, if you will, of their own culture and be compassionate. We have friends of ours you know, who have adopted a daughter, you know, from Ethiopia. You know, this little girl, Zachary, was left on a roadside. And she is this beautiful, bright little girl who, you know, was unfortunately abandoned. But, you know, here is this, you know, typical salt of the earth family here in North Texas, who adopted her and took her in. We have another set of friends of ours who have opened their home to a family of refugees from the Middle East. And so these kind of cross-cultural connections that are being made, I think are very moving because it speaks to something, honestly, that's very human. And that is this idea of compassion. I think of it as a very Kantian sort of attitude, if you will. If you see someone hurting, you have an obligation to help. And I see that here in Worf. And as we talked about on top of the episode, you know, maybe to appease his own sense of guilt or to appease his own sense of honor or duty, I'm not sure. I rather like to make the connection to his own experiences and see him as someone who, in his own way of expressing the appreciation for what his human parents did for him, he is now paying it forward and doing for somebody else.
Yeah, I think it's really clear that Worf is not just doing this totally out of duty. He's genuinely bothered by the situation himself, and he wants to help. And, you know, that's the way that Michael Dorn portrays mm-hmm. it, and it's the way he acts it, and it's the way he plays out the episode. But but you could read it either way. There's it's probably a little bit of both, right? Worf is acting out of duty, and he feels some compassion. And I think he's kind of using the Klingon rituals as a way of easing the emotional tension rather than using the emotions to get at the duty aspect. He really plays up the human element of it in the acting. Well, Mike, the last thing I wanted to talk about for just a moment is this question that Picard raises with Troy about whether or not we should really have children on the Enterprise, right? Space is dangerous. There are deaths. Here we have a parent being killed. Of course, that's part of the line of duty, but, you know, it could just as easily be a child being killed. If there's a firefight with the Romulans or whatnot, there could be an explosion and a child could be killed. I think Picard raises a really good point that maybe situations like this point to the fact that having children on the Enterprise is not a good idea. And I love what the Next Generation was trying to do with having children on the Enterprise. Certainly it serves this role for establishing Picard's character, right? Picard does not deal well with children, and that instantly tells you a lot about his character, that one tidbit, right? On the other hand, it seems like they were trying to make space seem a little bigger. The ship is bigger. They've got more people on board. There are families. It's a longer journey than 5 years. And they really wanted to go with this, not a generational ship aspect, but they wanted the journey of the Enterprise D to be a longer generation than a longer mission than a 5 year mission. So to the point where people would want to have their families, and you would need schools and libraries and a bar and all the things you would have to make a real city in space, and not just a small exploratory vessel out on a finite mission. But they never really went that direction with the Enterprise D. You know, I think they wanted to use that aspect to make space seem bigger. But really what they did is make it too easy to get back to Earth too often. So, you know, that the need to have children on board always seemed to be undercut by how small they really portrayed the Federation territory, you know, bounded by, you know, the Romulan Empire on the one side and, you know, the Cardassians on the other side. And you can always hop back to Earth whenever you want. So why the heck do we have children on
exactly.
board? Just doesn't make sense. And I think you can run the arguments, you know, why you would want to have children on board or not have children on board. People will be happier if they can have familial relationships. You know, there's this virtue ethics, care ethics aspect to just quality of life, right? You know, if you have your friends and your family, you're going to have a better life. So, yeah, sure, they're on the Enterprise. But then there's all the utilitarian arguments. You know, if it increases the likelihood of pain and suffering and whatnot, then that would be an argument not to have children on the Enterprise. But I guess my point is that I could see going either way. I'm not sure I have a deep opinion on it, but I think it's a shame they didn't go a little more fully on board with this idea that the Enterprise is a city in space, and they're out on this long-term exploratory mission. And so people, you need these things, and this is part of life on the Enterprise. So I always really like the life on the Enterprise scenes. I think they're interesting, you know, this is like a fantasy life for me, right? One of my fantasies is being on the Enterprise, right? And we already said we use Star Trek as our own fantasy escape sometimes. I have that fantasy, sure. So I want to see everything about what it's like to have life life on the Enterprise. And there's, I don't think we get enough of that. I think it's a shame we didn't see a bit more of that aspect of it.
Yeah, I'm gonna kind of step back and say this as a fan. I think the original intent for Wesley's character was to see this life in the 24th century through the eyes of a child. And I think it was a storytelling tool that was probably tucked away in the original intent of his character, but it was underutilized because he grew up so fast. And so, you know, here we are in the third season, and we have a story here that I think deals with, you know, that kind of, as you put it, you know, life on the Enterprise, and seeing that life through a child's eyes. And, you know, interestingly enough, Wesley you know, makes many comments about, you know, Jeremy's experience. In fact, we almost live Jeremy's experience through Wesley in this episode. You know, mm-hmm. he makes statements like, you know, I know what it's going to be like for him. And he has this conversation with Will Riker. You know, Will asks him, you know, do you know him well? He says, no, not really, but, you know, I know what it's going to be like. You know, Riker says, well, you know, Wes, that's part of life in Starfleet, buddy.
Yeah, and it seems like Wesley is having a harder time dealing with this than Jeremy.
Sure.
And one thing that always bothered me about the episode is just kind of the cold stoicism with which Jeremy Astor plays, you know, the actor plays Jeremy Astor. I mean, he really doesn't emote very much in this episode, you know, and that bothers me a little bit. I think it probably bothered the producers a little bit, too. But Wesley's just dripping with saccharin, yes, in this episode, right? He is feeling the pain of it, reliving his own father's death. Years later now, he's hearkening back and he's feeling it all over again. He does a great job of maybe overselling the emotion,
right?
But Jeremy is just cold as ice.
Well, there's a couple of observations there. You know, first of all, you know, Wesley says, you know, they do a really good job, or they're careful to prepare us for it. Them being Starfleet, obviously there's mm-hmm. some type of indoctrination for families who are living on starships in space. They're prepared for this, you know, this reality that mom or dad or, you know, both, could be lost in combat or on an away mission or something like this. But I think there's also another observation here, and that's just the shock factor of losing someone and kind of that shock of disbelief, if you will. I rather see Jeremy Astor in that kind of state. In fact, Deanna kind of alludes to that. He's being very brave, but we've got to get him past brave. We need him to emote a little bit. Mm-hmm. You and I were talking in the turbo lift, and you know that's one of the things that I felt was probably a little lacking in this episode. You know, from the very way that Jeremy's hair was slicked back, he had a very kind of 1950s Leave It to Beaver sort of look, and the fact that he didn't emote very much really harkened back to, you know, 50s and 60s TV. And then of course there's, you know, Marla Astor, who in a very, we didn't talk a lot about this, but in a very creepy way, kind of harkens back to Joan Crawford, Mommy Dearest. I'm waiting for her to walk into the room and go, Jeremy Astor, I told you no wire hangers on the Enterprise ever. It's just very kind of 1950s, 1960s kind of feel to this particular episode. Didn't feel very futuristic to me, but I think for the most part, you know, Children on the Enterprise was supposed to be a storytelling tool that unfortunately I think was underutilized a great deal. But I appreciate an episode like this being thrown in where we do get to see, even if it is the unfortunate reality, somewhat of, you know, what the realities might be for you know, a family, a boy living in space with his family.
Yeah, this is a really human story, and the Next Generation was great for these human stories. You know, I mean, I think the Next Generation in particular always struck me as a character-driven series. Yeah, there are action episodes, you know, like Best of mm-hmm. Both Worlds and whatnot, but largely the Next Generation is a human journey set in space, and the original Star Trek was the same way. And here we get to see a real human story, and I love that they take the time to dwell on it. I think this is something that really speaks to the pace of 1980. 90s television for me. You know, you've got this scene. It's a very talky scene with Picard and Troy in the turbo lift, and it's a long scene. They have this long conversation about whether there should be children on the Enterprise. I mean, in a way, it's a cheap scene, right? If you have two actors sitting there in a turbo lift, you don't have to make any special effects. So, you know, there are reasons they shoot scenes like that. But that was a totally acceptable feature of 1980s television. And they really take the time to ask the question. It's like shining the mirror right at the show. Should we have children on the ship? Is this a good idea or not? And you can imagine the writers and producers you know, leading up to the creation of The Next Generation asking this question. Well, should we put children on the Enterprise? Well, what about this? What about that? And they kind of do the philosophical deconstruction for you right there inside the episode. Yeah, it's great.
Absolutely. Any final thoughts, Zachary?
I don't think so. I think it's I never would have probably picked this episode to talk about in terms of the philosophy of Star Trek. There's no major theme here inside this episode. You know, we've got the meaningfulness or arbitrariness of death. We've got this question of whether life should be lived in a bubble or not. I'm not sure it's the best episode on either one of those things, but I like it because it's a real human story. And more, I think maybe as I get older, this is just my personal response to this. I think as I get older, I find these questions of meaningfulness and the arbitrariness of life, you know, what role does death play? I just find that more meaningful than I did 20 years ago. When I first watched this episode, I was probably, 13 years old, right? I had all my grandparents alive. I don't know if I even knew anyone who had died at that point. Maybe my great grandparents, right? I had no context for really appreciating the forcefulness of this episode, even though, you know, the main character in this episode is a child, Jeremy Astor. But as I get older and I see more of these experiences, and I've lost more people, I've been through more hardships, I've had more people drag me out of my own headspace sometimes. You know, those things speak to me more now than they ever did. And I just think, for me, those types of philosophical questions are not the questions of youth. Those are the questions that come up. You know, I think, you know, there's a reason Picard can speak to Jeremy about these things, right? You know, he's been through all of these things. It's his responsibility to speak to Jeremy about these things, not Worf's. And whatever the role Worf has to play, it's Picard who has to come along and really lay the groundwork for what life should mean. You know, having had all those experiences as the older statesman, so to speak, on board. And you know, I just appreciate it now more now, and maybe in 20 or 30 more years I'll appreciate it even more. But I think it's interesting to me that as I watch this episode in my current state, at my current age, with my current set of experiences, it's a very different reading of this episode than I would have got 20 years ago.
I really concur. I echo everything you said. And like you, I'm very fortunate, very blessed. You know, my wife of 21 years has pulled me out of more funks than I can even count, kicking and screaming, as I've dealt with not just death, but you know, with life occasionally as it happens. And So this particular episode has a lot of meaning for me, and like you, more so now that I'm at 45 years old. And so, I've seen, you know, more loss, and I'm, starting to wrestle a little bit with my own mortality, much more so, you know, than I did at, 17, 18 years old when I first saw this, episode. And so I have a greater appreciation for it. My only real final thought here is that I'm only sorry that we didn't revisit this storyline. And again, something that we did say earlier, you know, you've got a 42-minute episode to neatly wrap all of this up and you know, put a tidy bow on it and you know, call it that. And I know that wasn't indicative of, you know, late 80s, early 90s television, but I think it was a real opportunity missed to revisit this, to revisit the character, to revisit the relationship, to see how he's coped, how he's dealing with it, what happened to his character beyond this, apart from a very short note on Memory Alpha and a footnote that he happens to be a family member of Worf. We, you know, we don't really see it. You used to have that that game back in the day. Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? I've often found myself wondering, you know, where in the universe is Jeremy Astor? So,
Yeah, you know, the thing, it's like Chekhov, the question of where's Chekhov when Khan is on board, right? Right. Well, he's in the bathroom or something. You know, Jeremy Astor's there the whole time. He's just off camera. He's, you know, in the holodeck. You know, he's in Worf's quarters. You know, he's, you know, he's at school. You know, he's always there.
Yeah, he didn't even bother to show up to Worf's wedding. I mean, you know.
He's back on Earth with Worf's parents, you know.
Indeed. Indeed. But then that's really my only final thought. It's just a shame that we didn't get a chance to revisit this in the Star Trek universe, in the live action universe. We'll let Literature X and all of those guys talk about the books, but it's a shame that we didn't get to revisit him on the screen.
Well, Mike, I was really moved by your account of your wife pulling you out of your deep blue funk. So don't worry. Next time you're in a funk, next time you're down in the dumps, we'll make Roost Eye together, and it will be okay. I promise.
So what? I got nothing.
Reassuring words from your co-host here on Metatrex.
What are friends for? I appreciate that, and I want you to know that I would conduct the Roost Eye ceremony with you as well, and I can only say to you, sos ji batla so.
Oh, when we do finally get a chance to hang out in person, Roost Eye is on the agenda.
Roost Eye and blood wine for everyone.
Roost Eye is on the calendar. Okay. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about the bonding tonight, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
I want to hear Worf give a command sometime, like, 1/4 ramming speed, and then yes. Someone says, Captain... Regulation specifically states that we cannot go at 1/4 ramming speed while we are in orbit of a planet.
To the journey!
Let's say Voyager was going to a deep space mission. Is that wise for an endangered species to be going out here with the potential to be killed and then, of course, gets lost in the Delta Quadrant? I'm sure the Vulcans are going to love that.
The Ready Room.
You know, because he's appealing to the Ferengi side of Nog, which is still so much a part of who he is.
I'm glad he didn't offer him Umox, though.
Yeah, well, whoa. When you said he was going to shack up with Vic earlier, I was like, whoa, it didn't go that far.
The 602 Club. I feel like Man of Steel was a great groundwork to work from, and Batman v Superman, It had to build off of that, because if they didn't build off of Man of Steel, people would say, oh, they're trying to ignore perceived failure in the past. And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our handle is just @trekfm.
On Facebook, it's facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're there, check out the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not making Roostai, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, you can find me on Facebook as well. That's where I'm most active, certainly in the Babel Conference. Be sure and tag me in a comment if you want to interact with me or with Zachary. You can tag us both. And on Twitter, my handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not in 10 Forward with Riker contemplating the meaning of life and death, where can our listeners find you on the network and on the interwebs?
Well, likewise, the two best places are on Facebook and Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. And we'd also like to give a special thanks to our associate producer, Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick on Twitter under the handle @MagicDrop5, and we especially want to thank Patrick for suggesting this topic of MetaTreks today. It's thanks to Patrick that we're talking about the bonding today.
Yes, Patrick, we have bonded.
We've bonded together as a team. we've all made Roostai together.
Sos, chi, bitla, so.
Well, everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.